Welcome to the Terrible Podcast with your hosts, sports journalist David Todd, and from SteelersDepot.com, Dave Bryan. Just a couple of Daves, chillin', talking Steelers. Now, here's Dave and Dave.
Welcome to the Terrible Podcast with Dave and Dave, Season 8, Episode 121. I'm Dave Bryant from SteelersDepot.com, and sitting in for my co-host David Todd again is Alex Cazora, with just a few weeks remaining before the start of training camp. Alex, happy Tuesday. First one in June, or first one in July. Where did June go?
Yeah, I guess I went by fast for you. LeBron James taking his talents to L.A. Dave, we're staying right here, aren't we?
I've never been a huge basketball fan, but I was caught up in, you know, with Showtime and all, you know, Lakers when I was a kid and Magic Johnson and all like that. So I guess I kind of consider myself, if there was a team that I root for, silently root for, it would be the Lakers. But I mean, it's been eons since they've been anything, and you know, I don't know who's what. I mean, obviously LeBron is a big name, and I see they, you know, they obviously have ball kid over there.
Lonzo Ball.
Yeah, and but look, I mean, what was it? Was it 4 years, 150? Is that what it was?
454. That fourth is a player option.
Wow. And how
fully guaranteed.
And how old is LeBron now?
33, I believe.
I mean, this is it for him, right? You think?
Yeah. It's just kind of weird. I mean, obviously LA likes the place. He knows the place. Magic Johnson, all that. But from a team and from a winning perspective, you're in the West. You're not better than Golden State, especially after they added, you know, DeMarcus Cousins. I just thought it was a weird fit. I thought, you know, if he wanted to win, go to Philly. I think you're with a really strong team. You're staying in the East. So I just thought it was a curious decision because I don't know how LeBron is going to be a championship contender this year, and who knows what happens beyond this year.
How much money has he made in his career?
Oh, man.
Do you know?
I mean, I don't have my Darren Revelle cap on right now, but $1 billion, maybe close to it. I mean, honestly, it's not even just from what he's earned as a player, but what he's earned in advertising and marketing and all the money there. Let's try to look that up real quick.
Yeah, I just hit me his age, and I mean, you know, mega contract after mega contract he's had throughout his career and all. I tell you what's funny too is to see. I mean, look, NFL players silently want to be NBA players, I think.
I think they're vocally saying that, some of them are.
Well, not only because of guaranteed, you know, contracts and all like that, but, several of them are obviously LeBron fans, and it doesn't matter what uniform he wears, and, you know, they'll follow him around. Le'Veon Bell being one of them, I think. Maybe Ryan Shazier is another one of them, but you got an answer there?
I couldn't find anything super concrete. I think this Business Insider says he's made $234 million in salary over his NBA career, but it says the majority of his net worth comes from endorsement deals. So yeah, by all is said and done, it'll probably be made $1 billion or something close to it in his basketball and endorsement career.
And you think he's going to have anything to do with the NBA after he does hang him up?
Yeah, I'm sure he'll still stay connected.
Ownership and all like that?
Yeah, that's probably harder to say if he will truly go the Magic Johnson route, but he'll be involved heavily, I think, in some regard.
All right. I mean, obviously it's hard to ignore those kind of headlines, especially when free agency starts for the NBA and all. But we'll see. I mean, look, if he can it will really be something if he can get L.A. to a championship here in the next couple of years, I think, especially with Golden mm-hmm. State and all that, you know, happening in the West and all like that. So
definitely.
All right. You know, I don't want to spend too much time on the Le'Veon Bell because we've already, you know, hit that backwards and forwards. But I got to thinking late last night and this morning about can you name a running back – a Steelers running back who went on to have even moderate success after leaving the Steelers? We know it wasn't Rashard Mendenhall, right?
Well, he didn't. Some would say he didn't have moderate success with the Steelers.
Right,
let alone
right.
without. I'm sure if I thought about it, you could do a name. I mean, I guess you're asking somebody that played kind of heavily and wasn't just a, you know, very brief time as a rookie or something.
Right. Well, even outside of that, you know, even, you know, let's say kind of like a bit player or something like that that went on to have, I don't know, 1,000 yard or 1,000. You know, 1,000 yards combined or something like that after leaving the Steelers.
So it's just weird. It feels like once they get a back, he just retires with them, you know, whether that's Pettis or Parker or even like Welday Moore and names like that. I mean, Bell's going to have success, though. You know, he's not going to be a nobody if he leaves Pittsburgh.
Well, I mean, it would be the first, though. Or you know, I'd struggle coming up with a name. I mean, obviously, Franco. I mean, I about
but
cried.
But he didn't have success.
Right. No. I mean, I about cried when I was – no, he had zeros. I mean, I don't think he even lasted a full season with the Seahawks.
No, he got cut midway.
After leaving the Steelers. And just, you know, I'm trying to rack my brain and I just can't come up with a running back that even had kind of
– Preston Pearson back – he was in the Super Bowl with Dallas. I don't know how successful he was back in the 70s. I'll look up what his stats were.
Yeah, I mean, did he have, you know, I would guess he didn't have 1,000 combined yards.
No, it was pretty short-lived. The year after he went to Dallas in 75, he rushed for 500 yards, 2 touchdowns, but those 500 yards were his career high and as a Cowboy.
I mean,
he did some stuff as a receiver, but...
You know, not that that means anything, and like you said, I mean, you would expect Bell, you know, assuming... This is his final year in Pittsburgh to have some success, you know.
Yeah, the Steelers have never lost a guy like Le'Veon Bell. You know, the other guys may not have had success, but no one's been even close to the talent that Bell is.
Yeah, that's true as well too. But I mean, you can go around the league though and find guys like Shady McCoy and you know who started his career with one team and went on to have success with others. You know, kind of an all-purpose back. As far as that goes. So, I mean, yeah, it's not unthinkable. It's just I was trying to – something hit me last night trying to think of a running back that once the Steelers moved on from them, that they had success. Well, you know, like I said, I didn't want to spend too much time on it, but here we are less than 2 weeks to go. And obviously I have said all along that I don't think anything gets done before July 4th, and here we are July 4th being tomorrow. So that – that doesn't sound like anything's going to happen then. And then, you know, deadlines will spur whatever action you would think. What, you know, will the Steelers put a better deal, you know, one better deal on the table, or do you think it's out there waiting for it to be signed and that's it?
I think we'll put a better deal in these next 2 weeks because I don't think there's been a lot of talk since placing the franchise tag on him. So I think the team will go one step further as their one last best offer. I think that they obviously what's ever on the table now isn't enough to get it done. And I believe the Steelers are still acting in good faith and want to get this deal done. So yes, I don't think it's going to be a substantially bigger deal. I couldn't tell you the exact details of that contract offer, but I believe it'll be the largest one they've ever offered and it'll either get done or it won't get done.
Yeah, and I'm sure we'll have if it doesn't get done, we'll have another report come out about what he reportedly turned down, you know, and then kind of go from there. But the fact of the matter is it will be put to bed within 2 weeks from now. All right, perfect time then now, I guess, to kind of segue into we kind of previewed the quarterbacks already as part of our training camp. Preview or quarterbacks, and then you know, moving on now in talking about the running backs. I mean, what is there to say about the running back position? I mean, it starts and ends obviously with Le'Veon Bell. I mean, we've had talks where I mean we expect him to play the same, roughly about the same amount of snaps that he did last year. Bell recently came out and how much he knows about it. You know, probably yet to be determined, but he thinks that he might see a few less carries and a little bit more work out in space as a receiver. But then when you look at his receiving numbers from the last few years, it's hard to imagine him going any higher than that. And he would have to come close to, you know, the 100 reception mark. And, you know, that's just it doesn't sound plausible to me.
Yeah, I think we'll be right around the numbers he had last year. You can give or take, you know, 5 receptions either way and 20 carries either way. But, you know, Bell's going to be used whatever the game plan calls for. If that's going to be a game where they're passing more, whether that's a game situation, score situation, or just, you know, the game plan in general where he's going to be flexed out more, then he can do that. If it's going to call for more ground and pound attack, he's going to do that. So, you know, I don't put myself in a box of, well, that's just going to be Bell stats, you know, just out of thin air. It's just he's so versatile and so well-equipped to do run, catch, block, whatever, that, you know, he can just put up whatever the game plan calls for that week.
Combined yards last year for Bell, what, 1946, and obviously sat out the regular season finale. So, you know, basically, you know, 2,000 combined yards would have been in a bag. Is he going to hit that number in 2018?
I mean, I'll lean a yes just because I believe he'll rip off a couple of big runs. You know, last year I think his long was 27. I get reminded of that all the time. I talk about Bell on Twitter. His long was only 27. He doesn't have speed. He didn't have speed to begin with. And I think just naturally some of those long runs happen just because of breakdowns defensively, good blocking from the receivers, just kind of, you know, everything has to kind of fall into place. So, you know, I think if Bell goes to another year, he'll have a couple other long gains in the run game. So, sure, I'll say above 2,000.
You know, what he doesn't do in explosive runs, and, you know, there's you know, some will tell you an explosive run should be 10 yards. Some will tell you that it should be a traditional 20 yards. What he doesn't get in that, he makes up in explosiveness as a receiver. And I think, what was the stat that I pulled a couple of weeks ago since he came into the league? I think him and Giovanni Bernard are tied for, it's either, I think it's explosive plays by running backs, period, of 20 yards or more. So, I mean, he still gets the explosive 20-yard plays. It's just not on the ground.
Yeah, and it's just not 80-yard plays where he runs away from every single guy. Yeah, I mean, if you look at the receiver, because you have to look at Bell's little package. You can't just look at his runs and say his long's only 27. He made how many plays of 20, 30, 40-plus as a receiver last year against the Bengals alone? He did it, what, two or three times, I think. So that's what he offers you, is that unique ability. And again, the thing that I admire most about Le'Veon Bell, above every other, you know, physical trait, his elusiveness, his patience, his receiving ability, all that, is just the durability and the consistency and the stamina that he has. This is a guy that plays 90% of the time over the course of a year. He'll play 95% of the snaps in some games where it's called for, and he just doesn't miss a beat. I mean, you look at that long catch and run he had against the Bengals last year where he stiff-armed Drake Kirkpatrick's face into the ground and popped him back up. I mean, that was an incredible play on its own, but the thing that I kind of marveled at the most was that after that play, you know, 42-yard reception, he's running all over the field, he stays in the game for the next three snaps, and he gets the handoff the next time. I mean, you know that virtually every other running back in the league, maybe Todd Gurley aside, is tapping out after that play, and they're putting the backup in. Bell just comes in, and he gets next carry, and it's business as usual. That is really rare and really understated, I think, with Le'Veon Bell. You look at what makes a guy like Antonio Brown great. It's his conditioning, it's his stamina, and now he's the same guy in the first quarter as he is in the fourth quarter. Bell is in that same boat, and that will make him, that's what makes him so impressive to me, is that durability, that stamina, and that he just never seems to slow down.
And then there's no stats for it, but pass protection as well, too.
Yeah, one of the best. I mean, it's hard to quantify exactly where he's at. I mean, that's such a niche thing that you have from, you know, third down backs, that's really what they're known for, receiving and blocking. They don't have to do much as a runner. So, you know, I think Bell would be top five in terms of pass protectors in the league. If you look at starting running backs and true running backs, he's probably first, maybe second at worst. Yeah, that Tennessee game last year, you look at that. I mean, he was just excellent in pass pro. And also, you know, I think he, in a way, and I've talked about this before, Dave, he's kept, you know, Ben's career prolonged and going and being that check down option where Ben has so much trust in Bell that when a play breaks down, he'll just dump it off to Le'Veon Bell, let him do his thing. And that's going to help, you know, Ben save himself from hits and sacks and all that wear and tear. You look at when plays like James Conner or other running backs come in, Ben holds onto the football a lot longer. He takes more sacks because he just doesn't have that trust in his running back to know where he's at and trust him to make the play downfield.
What do you read into I posted this in my seven shots on Sunday, the Pro Football Focus stat, yards per carry on run pass options in 2017, the Steelers were in the bottom five of the league at 3.6 yards per carry. Does that mean anything to you?
I mean, weren't their yards per carry in general pretty poor? I mean, Bell only averaged 4 yards per carry on the whole year. So what did they rank overall in yards per carry?
Well, it says 3.6.
And, yeah, but I'm just talking about... They were 3.8
overall,
all rushes. They were 3.8. They were 25th. So I'm not totally shocked that they didn't have a good average in a particular subset of the run game.
Right. It would be better to see that on a success rate, you know, because 3 mm-hmm. yards doesn't always mean 3 yards. I mean,
right.
You know, give me 3 yards on 3rd and 1 and I'm happy, mm-hmm. you know,
right.
give
right.
me 3 yards on 1st and 10 and I'm not happy. You know,
right.
that kind of thing. So it's a little bit, you know, I posted it just as, okay, look at this. But, I mean, there's a lot more, obviously. That stat's kind of hollow, right?
Yeah, and when you're an offense that doesn't get a lot of explosive runs, I'm looking at the stat now. Their longest run, the Steelers last year, was 29 yards. That was 31st, and the NFL only had a Cincinnati. So when you don't have the occasional 50 or 80-yard gain, it's going to bring that average down because you don't have that outlier to boost it up. So I'd be curious to look at it from a different perspective, maybe a median or some other variable to look at the average instead of the average.
On the flip side, on run-pass options, 8.5 yards per attempt. Steelers in the top five of the league, according to Pro Football Focus, when it comes to run-pass options. So, once again, it's a nice graphic. It's fun to look at, but, you know, you need to, I think, drill down a little bit deeper into those. I'm not worried overall about the Steelers' running game. You know, the biggest thing I think with Bell and the Steelers running game is if he's not in camp in time again, and, you know, hopefully not getting off to a little bit sluggish start like they did last year.
Yeah. And like I said, I think on a previous podcast, you know, the good thing is they all acknowledge that it was an issue last year. Their head isn't in the sand and they're not saying, oh, it was fine. And look at the great year that, you know, I had if you're Le'Veon Bell and I'll do this things the exact same way. Now, obviously, it'll be disappointing for Bell to miss all that time. And it's still going to be a challenge. It's still going to be an issue no matter what you try to do to combat it. You know, you're missing the entire preseason and that's going to be a hindrance on you as a player. And as a unit, but hopefully they can just kind of attack it a little bit better this time around.
All right, behind Bell, you know, James Conner obviously coming off of that knee injury last year. He didn't carry the ball much or didn't touch the football much at all during his rookie season. He probably would have touched it a little bit more had he shown something in that Week 5 game against Jacksonville from a pass protection issue, but it just seemed from that point forward that, you know, that he wasn't going to be involved that much in the offense, nor should he be when you've got a healthy Le'Veon Bell out there. But is there any reason to think that he won't be the primary backup to Bell this year?
Well, it'll be interesting to see the split with him and Jalen Samuels because they are two different skill sets. Samuels is a guy that's known as a receiver and kind of that versatility. Connor's a little bit more one note, at least from what we've seen so far, and but was successful as a runner. So, you know, I kind of go into year two as a clean slate for James Conner. All he went through coming out of Pitt, you know, beating cancer and all that. You know, I just want to see him fully focused on football, fully healthy. I know Tomlin's talked about how he's, I think, lost some weight or at least is in, you know, really good shape and really good conditioning. And that happened with Bell, happens with most backs when they come out, they drop some pounds, they get in better shape. So, you know, I don't want to harp too much on the Jacksonville game, which, yeah, was ugly. But, you know, it's a Week 5 game of your rookie year. Let's see what you can do year two. I give you the benefit of the doubt and hopefully he can do those little things. And because, you know, he can run. You know, he showed vision. He showed burst. He showed a little bit of power. It's about, you know, rounding out his game and being in better shape. To be more consistent.
And he had a couple of nice runs outside of the tackles last
mm-hmm.
year.
Yeah, he's got a little extra, you know, get up, and if he lost some weight and got in better shape, that might be even better. So there's reason to be excited for him. You know, I'll give his rookie season a pass.
And then you go back to his time at Pitt, and I remember breaking this down. I mean, between the tackles, he you know, although it was college, I mean, he was an explosive back. I mean, he surprisingly had a lot of explosive runs at Pitt, and mm-hmm. you know, you would think that, you know, especially being in better condition now and having a you know a season under his belt now, that, you know, there are going to be opportunities for him at certain points during the game to come in and bust one.
Yeah, you're going to come in fresh, so you got to make plays like you're the freshest guy on the field. And it's not going to be a lot of opportunities. It's going to be probably a series. It might be a third and one, whatever the case is. You got to capitalize on them. I mean, the window of opportunity is still going to be limited. I mean, best case scenario, Dave, what do you think is the percentage of snaps he plays this year? 10, 15% max?
Wow, I mean, I would think if he was able to get six offensive snaps a game, that would be high, right?
I mean, yeah, probably gets five a game.
You know, even if he got five a game, let's just go through 15 games because we don't know what's going to happen in week 16. I mean, 5 times 15 is what? What is that? 25, 75?
75. Yeah. I mean, if he plays 5 of 70 snaps, like if there's 70 snaps in a game, he plays 5, that's 7%. So you're averaging about 7% of the snaps.
So we don't expect him to, barring injury. I mean, if he busts the 100 snap mark, it's because he got 20 touches in the season finale, right?
Yeah, or some sort of blowout. Yeah, or there was an injury. But probably, yeah, he's probably going to play less than 10% of the time in non-blowout finale stuff.
All right. Are you fully Stephon Ridley coming back, Fitzgerald Toussaint? I mean, barring anything unexpected with an injury, I mean, are you? I mean, I think you at one time have said maybe this offseason is probably not totally out. You know, wouldn't be totally surprising if they kept four total running. But I mean, that just seems a little high, right? I mean.
I don't know if I said they would keep four. I think I said something about I'm trying to think what I said. I don't know what I said. I think it's still going to be three, though, and I think it's going to be Bell, Connor, and Jalen Samuels.
And Samuels is a guy we've talked about quite a bit since he was drafted. And I think look, make no mistake about it. If he makes his team, he's going to have to play some special teams.
Mm-hmm. And he's done it before. That's not new to him.
Right, and he especially did it during his first couple years, I think, at North Carolina State. I think he had something like, I don't know, was it 5 or 6 special teams tackles during his college career? It's something he's going to have to do, though, to make this team. We've seen Fitzgerald Toussaint have to do that, although most of his seem to come as kind of like as on kick returns, although he did do some coverage stuff on – well, heck, we've even seen Fitzgerald Toussaint. Didn't we see during the preseason last year him get work even as the up back?
He's been the backup up back behind Robert Golden in camp.
So it makes you wonder – that's just going to be something to watch during the preseason when it comes to him, because we fully expect him, if he makes the team, to be number three, right?
I mean, if he were to make it, yeah, it'd be number three. I think his path is going to be just some of the trust and some of the known commodity they have in him. The kick return spot, I know that Juju might still be back there, but they've had Toussaint do kicks before, so I don't know how the new rule change is going to affect their philosophy, but he's got that advantage. He's run down kicks. He's the backup up bag. Now I think Burhey's going to be the starter firmly entrenched there. There's really good running back depth. I'll give, you know, as much as you can say about Toussaint or Ridley or whatever, to be the number five back on this team is pretty good, if you ask me.
Yeah, and Ridley, look, I mean, it was a great, or I think calling it even a great story is a reach. He had his moments last year, but, I mean, he is – something has to go wrong, I think, or Samuels really has to flounder in order for one of those other two. And look, Fitzgerald Toussaint, I still state that his pass protection is a little bit underrated, even after all this time. But I think it starts and ends there with him.
Yeah, and Ridley's a good runner. We don't know much about him as a receiver or much about him in pass protection. We'll certainly get a better look throughout, you know, prolonged training camp and preseason. But, yeah, if there's an injury or, like you said, if someone flounders, I mean, that's a guy that you know can come and carry the football and be pretty successful. Everything else in special teams, maybe a little less so, but I think you have a guy that can be a good true number two kind of runner should something happen to Connor or Jalen Samuels.
All right, what about the kid out of Western Michigan, Franklin?
Javarian Franklin. Steelers like their backs big, and they don't come much bigger than Franklin. I think he weighed in at like 230 pounds. He had a great career at Western Michigan. Ran with a core four Steelers third round pick. So we've seen Steelers keep big backs in the practice squad before. So I think that's going to be Franklin's ticket. Course can be about conditioning and doing the little things, receiving pass protection. That's all going to be probably pretty new to him compared to what he did in college, but he's got a little bit of explosion to him, and like I said, Steelers like their backs to be big and powerful, and they usually keep a big 230 pounder on the practice squad.
All right, so odds on favorite for him to make the practice squad as we sit here right now?
Yeah, I'm not even sure if Toussaint's still eligible at this point. His situation's so weird. Ridley, I don't think, is anymore. And, you know, Samuels, I think, hopefully can make the 53. So then you're just competing with James Summers to make it.
And he is a kid that had a cup of coffee, I think, with the Cardinals, Summers.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he's an interesting guy. He was a quarterback. He went to a JUCO. I'm supposed to go to NC State or North Carolina. It didn't work out there. So he goes to a JUCO, plays quarterback, then transfers to East Carolina, where he was mostly a running back, but even play a little quarterback as well. So maybe they throw a trick play his way. But yeah, you know, again, big back. Let me see what they list him at on the site. 6'3", 210. Again, Steelers like their backs to be big. And then, like I said, I think the depth there is stronger than what it usually is. And while I don't expect Summers, certainly not make the 53 in practice squad, it's going to be tough. He'll get an opportunity because, you know, no Bell's going to be there. You're going to have, you know, guys probably get some off days and guys to get, you know, injured. So we'll see what he can do.
I guess we go ahead and throw some fullback in there, Roosevelt Nix. I mean, this is a guy that probably silently one of the better fullbacks in the league, right?
Yeah, in terms of, especially as a coverage guy, special teamer, he's fantastic. I mean, he's no like Kyle Juszczyk that's going to be the Swiss Army knife that's going to be a true threat as a receiver or as a runner, but as a blocker and a special teamer and just an all-around good guy and kind of tone setter, I think he's one of the best.
Yeah, he is a guy that, I don't know, what are you looking at snaps out of him? 10 a game?
Yeah.
Can he get 150 to 200 snaps? Should we pencil that in?
200, I mean, it could be a little borderline. It's just going to be game plan dependent. I mean, I think that's really, truly what it is. It's not necessarily how many snaps can we get Rosie. It's just how much stuff we're going to run out of 12 personnel or 22 personnel, 23 personnel, those kind of game situation stuff. So it's hard to really peg that snap because I don't think you necessarily know it broadly how many snaps you're going to get going into a year. It's really, you know, one week he might play 20 snaps. Next week he might play two snaps. It's just going to be game flow and game plan and all that stuff.
All right. Anything else to add when it comes to previewing the running back position? I mean, we all know it starts and ends with Le'Veon Bell, and if he stays healthy, then everything should be fine.
I think it's a good group. You know, I'll just reiterate what I said. I think top to bottom, there's a lot of talent here. Even the bottom guys like Franklin and Summers have, I think, some level of intrigue more than some guys in the past, like, you know, Jordan Hall and, you know, guys that just really felt like they weren't doing anything. So we'll see what happens. But, I think I'm confident in this group, and there's a lot of young talent, and I'm excited to see how they're growing and maturing.
All right. You ready to move on from that?
Yeah. Do you have anything else to add? Any other?
No. It's all Le'Veon Bell. And are you concerned any if Bell doesn't get a deal done that, takes the attitude of protecting himself a little bit?
No, because he's got to get paid. I mean, even with his track record, he knows if he has a poor year, teams are going to use that against him, and he might not get exactly what he wants. I think he's a competitor. I think he wants to win, still wants to win a Super Bowl. So, no, I don't think he's going to dog it or anything remotely similar to that.
Tap out a few plays.
He hasn't. He's never done it before. I don't think he's going to start now.
I don't think so either. I mean, he's a productive back, plain and simple. I mean, he is a productive back. He's just such a weapon. I would like to see them try to get him out in space a little bit more. I doubt we're going to see any of the two, you know, much of any of the two running backs on the field. Although you and I could probably come up with some interesting play designs if they were able to do something with two running backs on the field.
I know you we haven't seen Jalen Samuels. We've only seen a little bit of James Conner. But who would you rather have on the field, Jesse James or Jalen Samuels or James Conner?
Yeah, that's a good question. I mean,
I think Samuels is going to give you more as a receiver than just Jesse James. Conner won't.
And at least if you did roll him out there as a second back, you could go off of what you see across from you, and you know maybe line him up, you know move him around or put him in the backfield. You know, based entirely what you see personnel or you know line up across from you. Look, I mean Jesse is what he is. He's a number two tight end.
Mm-hmm.
You know he's. Not as good as a blocker as Matt Spaeth was by any stretch of the imagination, but he's probably he's a better receiver than Matt Spaeth was. So he's not a guy that's going to get you yards after the catch kind of guy. He's had a few drops in his career as well too. You know, I would just like to see two backs just to see it, I think.
Yeah.
You know?
Saw a little bit before we're at D'Angelo Williams and Bell. Seen a little problem.
Right, right. Well, especially the start of 2000 and – oh, I'm trying to remember what – well, Bell was
– Yeah, I'm not going to remember when it was.
Yeah, Bell was suspended. But, I mean, we have seen it very briefly, but not nothing where we can circle it and say –
Sure.
You know, that kind of, it's not something that we expect a lot of regardless anyway there. So,
yeah. And that was under Haley, so it's not necessarily what Fitner's going to want to do. I mean, yeah, I would just say, you know, in my scenario, if you have Samuels and Bell in the game, you can split Samuels out. You'll get more as a receiver than Jesse James. And, you know, if you have Connor in the game, Connor's in the backfield, Bell split out, and you get that, you know, receiving, rushing element from both those guys. Because you're not splitting Connor out, because that's just useless to do.
Right, right. Okay, moving on. Part of a byproduct of going through and contextualizing every throw Mason Rudolph made last year, I got a lot of good data on James Washington too, and I recently posted about, I wanted to look at what kind of threat he is inside the red zone. We all know James Washington can stretch the field. We all know that he is a deep a player that can make big plays happen deep down the field. And I think even in an earlier post, I showed that he's not just a deep receiver either. We see him run those quick slants. We see him run the comeback. We see him run the curl. Did I say slant? The post, skinny and long post. And we see him run those 11, 12 speed outs. So he is a well-rounded receiver. He's not just a deep threat, but I wanted to go in kind of a little bit deeper and see what kind of red zone target he was, not only last year at Oklahoma State, but during his entire career. And thankfully, due to the magic of YouTube, I was able to go back and find all but two of his college targets from when it went inside the red zone, and he put up some decent numbers in there. He really did. And in fact, my research shows that in his 4 years at Oklahoma State that he was targeted inside the red zone a total of 41 times. Those targets resulted in 18 receptions for 149 yards and 11 touchdowns. However, it is worth noting that two of those red zone touchdown receptions came via those end arounds where the quarterback just flips it not even 1 yard forward, and then it's him doing the rest, catching the ball behind, you know, in the middle of the field behind the line of scrimmage, and essentially becomes a running back at that point. So two of those 11 touchdowns happened that way. They like to use the fade with him in the end zone to the right side. One thing that and I noted this right from the get-go with him is, boy, he sure did line up on the right side. geez, probably 90, 8%, 99% of his college career at Oklahoma State. That, you know, that's not factual. I don't have stats to back that up. But, I mean, just as much tape as I've watched of him, he was a right side guy. So that'll be one thing to watch for. And in fact, I don't know if you saw the post or tweet the video that I posted on Twitter within this last week. It was like finding kind of a two-horned unicorn. Him catching a deep post touchdown pass after lining up on the left side. It's just a rarity with him. But back to the red zone. They targeted him quite a bit with the fade in there, and he had some success in that area. I think even of the four incompletions thrown his way on that route inside the red zone, he actually caught him, but he caught him out of bounds. There were a few nice pass breakups in those situations. He had a couple of touchdowns to go along with it. He also would run that quick slant down deep there, and then you know, kind of further out, you know, 19, 20 yard line, 18 yard line, he would kind of run that deep, that deeper post to the back of the end zone, and had one or two touchdowns that way as well too. I think the thing that stuck out the most to me with him and those fades is he's not a guy that's going to go up and really sky over a defender for a fade. So while he did have some success, some moderate success in that area, I don't view him at the NFL level as being a prime red zone receiver.
So you think they have to scheme it more to get him open, or he's just not going to be a threat there, or run after catch stuff, or how do you think they should get him involved?
I think if you're 15 yards out, you know, you can do something with him there. Now, obviously, it's not like they're not going to try to fade. If they get the matchup that they like, sure, especially with a smallish kind of corner maybe on his side or whatnot, try to run that fade. But, you know, he just doesn't have that feel of a dominant red zone guy, especially down in the area of 12 yards and in.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I think the profile's there. You know, I think you wrote that he jumped 34 and a half inches at combine, which is a pretty average number. But he went to his pro day, he jumped 39. So, you know, I think he's shown he can have some hops. I think one of the traits I saw just overall was his ability to make combative catches and tough catches downfield. It's kind of how he wins as a deep threat, because he doesn't have the pure speed. I don't know. I feel like just playing in the Oklahoma State offense, where it is so wide open, you don't take those really tough throws in the red zone. Maybe I'm wrong. You saw it. I haven't. And I feel like in the NFL, you're going to be forced to make some of those tough plays. So I feel like that, you know, Washington situation in college didn't let him show that ability, because, you know, he didn't have to, because he didn't let that offense go to the open receiver. You don't have to make a combative and a tough play in the red zone. But maybe I'm totally wrong on that.
How many times do you remember in highlights of his, of him actually really skying high to and catching the ball up over his head, you know, kind of thing? I mean,
look,
I'm not discounting him, because I think the more you watch of this kid, of his tape, the more impressed you get. I mean, not only from his ability to get open down the field he's not a burner, but I think you keep going back to the fact that one of the things that Randy Feitner said is he might not be a 4.4 guy, but he'll consistently run 4.5, and I think he's so good coming in and out of his breaks that he gets open. And that's down the field too, and just the combative catches. That he's the kind of guy that you can throw the ball down the field when there is no large separation, 50-50 balls, so to speak, and put your money on him coming down with him.
Yeah, I mean, you're right. I don't really remember too many plays where he truly skied high and made this kind of ridiculous high-pointy play, but he's a guy that makes tough catches. And like you said, it's 50-50. My money's on James Washington, because he's got big hands. He's a tough guy. And that's how he won a lot of those deep balls, because he wasn't necessarily running away from every guy. I mean, it happened, obviously, but that probably won't always be the case in the NFL. It's going to be that much tougher. So I think he's a guy that can make those tough plays in the red zone. I think he profiles as a good red zone player like Juju does, because he's tough, he's physical, he's got good hands, he's a nuanced route runner, he knows how to get open, and that's all going to be traits that make you successful between the 20s or inside the 20s.
I mean, obviously, he's not prototypical Martavis Bryant, Plaxico Burress, kind of the Z that we've been accustomed to seeing over the years, right?
Yeah, definitely not.
But he does things in the intermediate area that some of those guys didn't do.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, how many times? I mean, we just didn't see Martavis do a lot outside of the deep ball.
Yeah, I think the idea is Washington's going to be a lot more well-rounded. Maybe not initially, but hopefully pretty quickly, for the Steelers' sake, than Bryant and even Burress was.
And the thing is, when it comes to a guy like him, really wide receivers in general, especially in Pittsburgh, the ability to play more than one position. So I think that will be part of his development, is seeing, is he a guy that you can, you know, that you can see play down the road in the slot, you know, or kind of play, you know, that kind of that prototypical that flanker spot, you know, that Hines Ward played. Will we see him eventually be able to move into that kind of kind of playing time on occasion?
I hope so. And honestly, Dave, I hope it happens really soon. You know, it happened with Juju last year. Juju was playing everywhere. It kind of needs to happen because, you know, you take away Antonio Brown by really doubling him and bracketing him. And the problem is, if you don't move Antonio Brown around and he stays in one spot, he stays in his X receiver spot, you can shut him down, basically. That happened in Miami in 2016. He got shut down because Todd Haley just did not move him from his spot. And the problem is, if Washington can't move, then you can't move AB either. You know, it takes two to tango. So if you're moving AB, someone else has to move as well. So that means Juju's got to be able to move. That means James Washington has to be able to move. So it's going to be really, I think, critical for him to start being able to just have the ability to do that, even if he's not doing it that often, because there are going to be games where, you know, teams are shutting down AB or they're really taking him away and doing a good job against it, and AB's got to play in the slot. He's got to play in the Z. He's got to, you know, just move around. He's got to play on a different side, get a different matchup or whatever. So I think that's going to be key, and hopefully Washington can do that. And I think Colbert's talked about how they have that expectation as well.
Right, and I think it's not really truly a red flag. It's just the fact that he played so much on the right side and lined up wide on that side is just one of the things you want to see him transition from.
Mm-hmm. No, definitely. You're right. No, you're right to point it out and to be worried about it, because something he has to prove. Because I just talked about the importance of it. You know, the Steelers have never played their receivers as left side, right side only guys. They're generally really versatile. Another reason why I think DHB is making this team, because he's the rare guy that can play all three spots with total, you know, trust and confidence. So yeah, something to definitely look out for.
And I think another thing aspect, we saw a little bit of it at Oklahoma State. He is a willing and able blocker when it comes to a wide receiver. So, you know, he's definitely going to be asked to, you know, Richard Mann, I used to love Richard Mann talking about dig out the safeties. And I think he has the mentality and the want to be able to do that. And it'll be interesting to watch that phase of his game as well, too. Because a lot of times that'll be, you know, those guys blocking on the edge is what separates that makes a 7-yard run go 25 yards.
Yep, absolutely. Good runs become great runs. Great runs become touchdowns when you have, you know, great downfield blocking. And yeah, I think Washington will definitely buy into that. And I think generally speaking, the Steelers receivers as a whole will have been able to buy into that. I think Dale Drake's philosophy is going to be pretty similar to Richard Mann. So Juju's a great blocker, obviously. But Davis Bryant, you know, give credit to Bryant, even though he's not here, was a really efficient and high-effort blocker last season. I think Washington's going to be the same way. And AB's the last thing of a good blocker, but they usually just try to get him with an outside release and a burst of speed off the line to turn the corner against press man. That kind of is his way to block, where he's just turning corners and getting vision off the football, because he is arguably the worst blocker in the NFL from a receiver standpoint.
All right, moving on from that study, I think, boy, I tell you, I've broken down Rudolph and Washington, and it's fun to have that kind of data to work with, the average distance, intended air yards. That's slowly becoming one of my new favorite stats, intended air yards, intended completed yards and stuff like that. I mean, obviously, we hope that we're not going to have to talk a lot about Mason Rudolph past the preseason, but you can bet that we're going to be contextualizing a lot of things that Rudolph and Washington do during the preseason, and then obviously Washington on into his rookie season of 2018. So it's fun to play with all that data, but I'm running out of ways to kind of break those two guys down now because I've attacked it from every angle. I've started kind of another little series. It's not going to – it won't last long because – you know, just not a lot to it. But contextualizing the 2017 receptions allowed by Steelers cornerback Artie Burns, I've already got weeks 1 through 5, and I'm going off of the data that Pro Football Focus does and what they charged, the receptions that they charged Artie Burns with allowing last year. And in total, they had him allowing 42 receptions for 579 yards and 4 touchdowns. When I went through games 1 through 5, 14 in total, Pro Football Focus charged him with. A lot of them don't look egregious at all. Were you able to watch and read any of that?
Yeah, I did thumb through right before we started the podcast, and yeah, a lot of zone, a lot of underneath curl stuff, and that's just kind of my issue with some of the Pro Football Focus charting. And I like PFF; they do a great job. I know there's a lot of debate about that, but I certainly appreciate and admire the work they put in because it's an insane volume of time and effort. But you know, it's the same with Bostic, where if you look at those plays, a lot of them you really can't defend. It's a 5-yard curl. You're playing, you know, cover three. You're playing a deep third, and you know, every corner is going to allow that, whether you're Deion Sanders or Artie Burns. So I think that's kind of unfair to Burns, and that's why whenever I do my charting, at least I only issue a target on plays where I thought the defensive back could have made a play on the football, where it's truly a combative or a tough catch to play. I'm not a 5-yard curl against cover three. I don't charge that to anyone. So there are a couple instances of man coverage. I think the Vikings game has one or two of that. Jacksonville, he got run off on a comeback, but you know, I think it's almost hard to even say too much about the results of that because most of them are just zone coverage, you know, checkdowns, basically.
Yeah, those short hitch routes are tough against, you know, against zone. And there was like 2 or 3 of those. What do you tend to call those more, hitch or short curls or what?
Yeah, just a curl, hitch, yeah, interchangeable.
And then again, you know, those quick out routes and all. I mean, if you got a good, I mean, look, NFL receivers are supposed to be able to break down quickly and turn that thing to the outside. And if that ball is thrown on time as that receiver's coming out of their right before that receiver's coming out of the break, then that's a next to impossible route to defend.
Right, and that's several times. I think even the last clip you have in there is, I think, Burns reading and jumping a play. Like, he came out of his assignment to rally on the football and made a bang-bang tackle, and he gets charged for that, which, okay, I guess it's a lot closer catch than an off-zone, you know, curl, but it's like Burns made a good play to read it, and he kind of gets penalized for it. So if you go into the details, again, I'm not trying to rag on PFF too much here, but you see kind of some of the oddities, I guess, of how they chart.
Right, and really, that's the one you're talking about against Jacksonville, where it was Hilton coming off the edge too, right? So, that's a hot anyway. So
yeah,
you know, and that's the way I viewed that play as being. You know, I mean, you basically Burns has got to make a decision on two guys out there.
Yeah, and then he just read the play. He made a good play. It was a bang bang, no yak at all. And again, he gets penalized. So it comes down as allowing a catch for whatever it was, 5 or 6 yards, but that was an objectively a really good play, and it kind of doesn't look like that in the numbers.
And then there's a couple in this batch of first 14 that he was charged with, running back screens. I mean, it's tough to charge a guy with that, you know. As is a wide, I think they had one in the Bears game to Cohen, Tariq Cohen, a wide receiver screen out of a, you know, with the running back in a bunch to the left side. You're not going to defend that. The biggest thing when looking at some of these plays such as that is A, is he either in on the tackle or is he forcing it back inside to help?
Yeah, yeah. For whatever it's worth, in my charting for last year, I have Burns allowing 19 catches on 44 targets for 329 yards, giving up 4 touchdowns and picking off 2 passes.
All right, now in this next bunch that I'm doing now, I've already carved up the I've got all the post almost ready to go later today. That was the game against remember the game against Kansas City and the long what was happening on that play? Do you remember what was happening on that play to
Robinson?
Thomas. Remember he got behind him
Thomas in Kansas City?
The black Mamba.
Why am I drawing a blank here?
Yeah, he's the one that got behind Artie on that one for the touchdown.
Oh yeah. That probably just more miscommunication. Something went weird there.
Right, that one's gonna show up in this one, and the Moncrief one, the long touchdown against the Colts. Now I think there's 4 that show up that he was charged with in Detroit. I think one of those was kind of the play breaking down. Remember Stafford going out, I think, to his left, and then who was it? Either Tate or Marvin Jones getting behind Artie on one of those. But I mean, you'll see. I think here's the thing that I think stuck out according to the readers on Steelers Depot. I think they were a little bit surprised how physical Artie was in this first batch of 14.
Yeah, and that's something I've said about Burns. He's not a shy guy. He doesn't shy away from contact. He is a physical, violent tackler. He can show that. We saw that at Miami. But it's just his issue has always been technique and being in the right spot to showcase that. So I've always thought it was unfair to paint Burns as someone that didn't want to tackle and didn't want to support the run and this, that, and the other. He wants to, and he does it really well when it all comes together. It's just he's so often out of position or not playing with good technique to find the football and get in position to make that kind of play that it looks like he's allergic to tackling, but I think nothing could be farther from the truth.
Yeah, I think it's going to be interesting to look at the comments, and I'm trying to leave these posts and these breakdowns without interjecting my own opinion into them to see what the reaction. If you were to poll most Steeler fans, what would their opinion be of Artie Burns coming out of last season?
He sucks. He's a bust. Cut him. Right. Honestly.
Right.
That's probably what the thought
and look, is. I wasn't a fan of the pick, initially, especially where it was in the first round. But I have a feeling that when I'm done with this series, maybe they're going to be a little bit more respect for him. But it will be interesting to see with this first batch of 5 games that I posted yesterday versus this next batch of 5, because there will be some big plays allowed in this one, to see how the tone in the comment section changes, though.
Yeah, like Sean Davis, like Bud Dupree, it's a make-or-break year for him. He's like those guys. The physical tools are there. We've seen some flashes. It's all about consistency, making those big plays, and just being good communicators, being in the right position and doing your job.
All right, we'll continue to, as I start finishing up this series. We'll start. You and I'll be talking a little bit more about the final few posts of this as we go through the remainder of the offseason before training camp gets underway. Alex, we have reached a time of year now where the major media types are going through and predicting the games of every NFL team, and NFL Network obviously is no different. James Jones and Maurice Jones-Drew attempted yesterday on the NFL Network to predict the outcome of the Steelers' 2018 regular season, and after a little bit of dickering on a few games, they have the Steelers going 10-6. James Jones was responsible for predicting the Steelers' first half of their schedule, and then Jones-Drew took over from there. I don't know how he can honestly believe this and say it with a straight face, but James Jones is in the opinion that the Steelers will drop both their games to the Cleveland Browns this year.
And I think as a commenter pointed out, didn't one of them or both of them have the Steelers beating the Patriots?
Jones-Drew did.
But he has them losing twice to the Browns.
No, they well, remember they split this up half and half. So, you know, they play. There was a little bit of dickering back and forth between the two when it came to should or shouldn't they give the Steelers the second loss to the Browns, and they both decided, okay, go ahead and let them get swept by the Browns, and then that influenced Maurice Jones-Drew to pick the Steelers to beat the Saints, and the I think he got down to whether or not he was undecided on the game against the Panthers and the game against the Saints, and he ended up giving the Steelers two wins. There, but look, I get the whole play down. I get where fans are worried about possibility of Steelers maybe losing one or two games to a team that they probably shouldn't. Okay, but really, the Browns twice. I mean, how honestly? I mean, I know even you, you probably ask. Asking you right now, you probably wouldn't be surprised if the Steelers dropped a game to the Browns, right?
No, I mean, it wouldn't shock me. I think the Browns would be a lot better this year. Heck, it was competitive last year in the first matchup. DeShone Kizer almost came back to beat the Steelers in week one. So I'm not discounting it. It's just, you know, it's all arbitrary. It's all meaningless. It's clearly unscientific. And it's just funny to watch to see them lose twice to Cleveland and then beat the Patriots.
Boy, yeah, if they lose twice to the they're gonna be some he has them going four. James Jones has them going 4-4 in the first eight games. Can you imagine the type of conversations we might have if the Steelers go 4-4 in the first eight games?
Yeah, better not happen, because that back half of the season is on paper at least, and that's kind of meaningless. But it looks a lot tougher than the first half.
He has them. They obviously play five. Five AFC North games in their first eight games of the season. They have them sweeping the Ravens, getting swept by the Browns, and then losing that first game to the Bengals, which I believe is in Pittsburgh. There, the losses they have them losing twice to the Browns, losing to the Falcons, losing to the Bengals, losing to the Jaguars, and losing to the Raiders out west.
Yeah, I don't put any stock into what these guys are saying. All I know is David Carr's hot takes, and these hot takes are good for business and get the natives restless, and so keep them coming, guys.
10-6, I mean, where are you at on this team right now?
Again, it's hard for me to come up with any number.
10-6 is always my number.
Yeah, I think this year I'd go more 11-5. I think that they can do well against the AFC North and probably win, maybe not sweep, but lose one. So we'll go 5-1 in the AFC North and get some wins early. So I think 11-5 is a reasonable expectation.
Patrick Mahomes week two, does that scare you at all?
I mean, I think Mahomes is going to be a good player, and with a guy that doesn't have a ton of tape even by then in week two, a guy that can, you know, hit you deep, and we know the Steelers' issues sometimes protecting the deep ball and some of those scramble drills. Yeah, I mean, the Chiefs are going to be a tough team.
Worried at all about Denver or San Diego later in the season?
San Diego.
I mean, LA.
I'm just teasing you. No, I think Chargers will be good. You know, I get scared of it all these games. I'm the worst person to ask about being scared, because I'm terrified by every team on the schedule, just because I've talked about it before, the way the Steelers teams are and how close these games are and the unpredictability of the NFL. So I'm probably the worst person to ask, because I'm nervous by every one of these teams.
We see crazy predictions all the time and all. And look, if you just give me a better reason about why you think the Browns are going to sweep the Steelers, you know,
exactly.
Give me a better reason, you know, is all I ask for. If you can sell it, you know, at least try to sell it to me, you know.
Right. That was my issue with Carr and Ben, because he was just saying supporting cast and didn't give a good reason for it.
Okay, on from that nonsense, what else do we have to talk about?
I just wanted to say real quick, did you see Terrell Owens? I know this is totally off topic, but did you see T.O.'s tweet from like 20 minutes ago?
Yeah, about he's going to announce where he's going to celebrate the Hall of Fame and all like that. I don't understand any of that.
Yeah, like I started to read it, and he says, I'll read it real quick. He says, as many of you know, I'm foregoing the Pro Football Hall of Fame induction ceremony in Canton after giving it much thought. And I thought at this point, he said, I changed my mind. I'm going to be at Canton. It's such a great opportunity. I'm coming back. He says, no. He says, I have realized just how much I want to celebrate. I've decided to give my Hall of Fame speech at the University of Tennessee at Chattanooga on Saturday, August 4th. The event is free and yada yada. So he's just – the spotlight's always on T.O., isn't it?
I just don't understand. Look, I mean, does he still have a vendetta about to whoever, the media, blah, you know? I just don't get it. You know, yeah. Such a monumental thing. I mean, look, they can't take it away from him, whatever happens. I mean, he's in now. It just doesn't say a lot about him, I you know, as a person, you know, I don't think.
I think he's going to regret it. For a long time.
I think he is too. Down, you know, not next year, not maybe 5 years from now, but you know, just such a monumental thing. Just go. I mean, I don't understand why he wouldn't. I really don't. I guess he's just sticking with that whole persona of his, and not maybe not liking the way he was treated by the media during certain points of his career. Whatever, you know, he's not the only diva wide receiver, you know.
Mm-hmm. That's true.
Yeah, I don't get any of that. I you know, there's still time for him to. I guess there's still time for him to change his mind, right?
I'd be a lot of people angry at Tennessee.
Yeah,
I don't know.
That's true. Thoughts on what Richard Mann had to say recently with the interview with Mike Byers?
It was
about
good.
Tomlin and AB and.
Yeah, the AB comments weren't shocking. You know, Mann saying AB's the best receiver he's ever coached. You know, I'm not surprised by that. But again, it's such a heavy and comment that's really worth something, because Mann's been coaching since 1970. He's seen been around as many guys as anybody almost in the history of the NFL. To give that kind of praise to AB, and Mann's probably not one to do that very often. I think it's very telling. And then the Tomlin thing too. I mean, you know, if you don't like Tomlin, you're not changing your mind at this point. But again, you know, Mann to call Tomlin the best overall coach he's been around. Very high praise for a guy that's been in football for much longer than I've been alive.
Boy, that you go look at a list. I mean, it's hard to believe he was even coaching Ozzie Newsome, you know, years
Did
ago.
He? Did he really?
As well, when he was with the Ravens, I think. So you just look at that list of wide receivers that Richard Mann coached during his career. I hope we don't see a drop off. You know, I mean, look, AB's AB. Not, you know, nobody could screw that up right now. Juju. It would have been nice to see Richard Mann be able to see Juju out another couple years, but then we would be saying it'd be nice to see him see out James Washington another, you know, there's no good time to have a guy like to lose a guy like Richard Mann. But Daryl Drake is an accomplished guy in his own right.
Yeah, he's cut from the similar cloth as Richard Mann, an old school guy, a guy that's been coaching. I think Drake's been in the NFL since 2002. I think he came out of Chicago or Denver. So again, they're similar styles. But you know, you're right. It's going to be tough. The Steelers lost a good chunk of their coaching staff. Leadership, Richard Mann, John Mitchell, you know, Carnell Lake. I mean, I wouldn't put him in anywhere close in that same category, but there's a lot of turnover there. So, but I think they got some really good replacements in Daryl Drake and Carl Dunbar. And from what everything I've heard about Tom Bradley, it's been very positive.
All right. Well, you ready to leave it with what we got there on tape already?
Yeah, I think that's going to be our best work.
All right. We'll see what happens between now and Friday. We may or may not have a surprise on Friday. I'm still efforting something, so I don't want to jinx that. But in the meantime, you can follow me on Twitter, @SteelersDepot. You can follow my co-host David Todd on Twitter, @DavidMTodd. Follow Alex Kozora, @Alex_Kozora. Follow the show, @TerriblePodcast. You can email the show, theterriblepodcast@gmail.com. If you like what we do and want to donate to the cause, go to SteelersDepot.com, hit that donate button up right, navigational bar. And until Friday, as always, and everybody have a happy 4th of July as well, too. As always, thanks for listening to The Terrible Podcast with Dave and Dave.